Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. The interview that aired before the break on LGBT people in corporate America was not such unusual content in 2015. In fact, stories about LGBT issues from marriage equality to business impact are commonplace in the media today.
Well, that wasn't the case in the 1960s. In those days, if anyone was covering those issues at all, it was alternative media and underground newspapers. That includes a Milwaukee paper called Kaleidoscope, which published more than 100 issues between 1967 and 1971.
For the first time, the Kaleidoscope archives are available in digital form, thanks to a collection organized by the UW-Milwaukee Libraries. Max Yella is head of special collections for the libraries. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski about the significance of the newspaper when it began.
At the time, there was no underground newspaper in Milwaukee, and I think there was a real need for it among the counterculture population of the city. The founders, Bob Reitman and John Coyce, John Solly, had talked about this for some time. The counterculture was really getting going around 1967 or so. As somebody pointed out, acid had just hit the city at that point. And a lot of political things were going on, a lot of social things were going on, and there were other newspapers around the country, and there, I think these three and others had decided that Milwaukee needed its own underground newspaper. How to get it off the ground was another story. They met several times, they worked really hard at this, and by 1967 they were ready to go with some borrowed money, and they came out with their first issue, sold out immediately.
Yeah, and it was originally sold for 25 cents, and we have a total of 105 biweekly issues in the time that it ran. Mm. So as you mentioned, with the political and cultural upheaval at the time, so for example, we have Vietnam, women's movement, civil rights, all of these things that these writers were responding to. And on the website of your digitized Kaleidoscope, there's a warning that says, you know, some images or messages may be offensive, but this is kept for the cultural record and to preserve and present what was going on at the time. So what kind of issue specifically was the newspaper responding to?
A wide range of political, social, and cultural issues. It was a very radical newspaper. I mean, it was radical liberal, more radical than any other newspaper in the region. And perhaps as radical or maybe more radical than other newspapers around the country. They were dealing with issues ranging from the oldest things you said, from political issues, social issues. They were among the first venues in this area to deal with LGBT issues, social justice issues, but they also covered music and poetry and the arts.
So with this wide range of topic and, as you mentioned, a radical liberal perspective critiquing most of the things that was going on during the day, how did people get involved in writing and distributing?
There was a circle of individuals who wanted to take part in this, and they began to get a lot of assistance from other people in their network and in their community. It was all volunteer-based, for the most part at least, and volunteers literally hit the streets with their papers, selling them, you know, in bars and selling them at bookstores and the Avant-Garde and Grand Falloon, venues where young people would meet and where the counterculture would gather.
So you mentioned volunteers is a big thing with this newspaper, and obviously they only had a P.O. box to speak of.
Yeah.
So with volunteers hitting the streets, and you mentioned it was mainly an east side, are you aware if they tried to expand beyond that?
So they were immediately popular in Milwaukee, and they had strong leadership, at least consistent leadership, through all the issues, and they had consistent writers, important writers at the time, who went on to work for other both radical newspapers and mainstream newspapers, and probably still do. But they also had a national appeal as well, and a lot of what they did was distributed to other places. They first started off with just a single tabloid issue, and within a few issues, they began to introduce what was called the second section. And that kind of compiled cultural news, non-local news, and they distributed that to other newspapers in the country. So that distribution and their name became broadcast, you know, nationwide. They also founded extensions in other cities, in Chicago for a very brief time, in Indianapolis and Madison. So they had other publishing possibilities around the country, particularly in the upper Midwest.
Okay. So with that wide distribution and reaching outside of Milwaukee, why did it end after 4 years?
Lots of different reasons. Well, the main reason, I guess, was not so much the political issues. Certainly they were plagued by being harassed by the powers that be, including the police,
mm-hmm.
certainly being taken to court later on for obscenity charges that John Coyce was convicted of and was sentenced to. It was taken to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court found that John was not liable for that kind of content, and the content itself was not obscene.
Yeah, it was said that it was the article was about censorship and it included a poem titled The Sex Poem and some photographs. But since it was about censorship, that it didn't constitute as obscenity.
Right. I guess the benchmark for obscenity is does it appeal to a prurient interest?
Mm-hmm.
And it was found that it just did not. But I think there were a lot of internal issues going on at the press. Again, everybody had their own agenda, and I think the leadership wanted that to happen. They had very diverse views on the staff, both cultural and political. I think there was kind of a schism between those who wanted to deal mainly with cultural issues and those who wanted to deal with political and social issues. But mainly is because they had a main printer up in Port Washington. His name was Bill Shannon. And he really supported – he was a publisher himself, and he really supported the printing of Kaleidoscope. And, you know, these guys never made a whole lot of money.
Right.
And they were always in arrears for payment of their debts, and certainly for Bill Shannon. Shannon himself really came under a lot of criticism, both in his community and the press itself. But he stood by them, and then he died unexpectedly. And his son, who I think is also named William Shannon, felt obliged to carry on his father's wishes, but at a certain point just couldn't give them credit anymore,
mm-hmm.
and refused to print after a while, and the paper closed.
So I was looking at some of the articles, and all issues are available to be viewed online, and
yes.
It is in good shape. You know, it's not hard to read. It's very easy to see and to view and to organize. So what was the process to get this newspaper digitized and archived onto the library websites?
That's a good question. First, we had to get the newspaper. We did have a copy of the newspaper, not a complete run, but a comprehensive run that was not in very good condition. We were missing a lot of the second sections.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a long story, but a project started at UWM to investigate the blues and folk revival in Milwaukee. And that was led by John Stropes, who heads the American Fingerstyle Guitar program at UWM, the music program. And he joined with Rebecca Holderness, a director and theater professor, to produce a couple of plays about this blues and folk revival. And they became really interested in the Avant-Garde Coffee House, a place where a lot of that revival happened in Milwaukee. A lot of really important things happened around the Avant-Garde. And so I was working with them to find sources and to help them produce this kind of work. In trying to find out more about the Avant-Garde, I suggested a number of things, including the Kaleidoscope, which John Stropes used our papers all that much, but then began to investigate it more and found that the Kaleidoscope and the Avant-Garde had a relationship with each other, mainly because the publishers met there a lot and hung out there and reviewed a lot of programs that were going on at the Avant-Garde, and began to investigate the Kaleidoscope itself as well as the Avant-Garde. And found that the people who were publishing were still around. One of the co-owners of the Avant-Garde, Gordy Simons, was still around. And it turned out that Gordy had a complete, pristine run of Kaleidoscope. And it came into John Strope's head that wouldn't it be great if we could digitize this really important American underground alternative newspaper, and came to us with that prospect. So it took some time, but not that much time, maybe a six-month period in which we officially acquired this complete run, had it cataloged, and then needed to seek some funding to get it digitized. We could have digitized it in-house, but we decided to go with an outside contractor. We went with a company named Backstage because they came in with a remarkably low bid, and I was a little skeptical about the bid being remarkably low.
Too good to be true.
Right, exactly. But, you know, we talked with them for a long time. We're going to do all the things we want them to do because my job as a special collections librarian is to preserve the paper as a physical artifact because you can gain access to information in this physical artifact that you just can't get even in a digitized form online.
Okay.
So what they were going to do that others they were willing to do but would cost us more would be not to chop up the paper, which would make it easier to scan. They were going to scan it and keep it intact and work with us on the preservation of the material while they were scanning it.
Well, that's pretty impressive. So as you were going through the newspaper, did you have any favorite articles that you came across while working on archiving it?
I don't know if I have favorite articles, but I was interested to see how one would use the paper for teaching and research, because that's basically why we have it, is for teaching and research as a documentation of the period. It's a primary source. It comes from this time. It's of its time. And so to see what kind of information I could glean from it was the fun aspect. I was also real interested to see how coverage of LGBT issues came to be. And it really, at first I thought that LGBT issues were covered very well before the Stonewall riots in New York, before 1960, the summer of 69. And I found out that really their coverage of these issues happened after that, in 1970. But then once they did, they were consistent and didn't back down from public pressure or from internal pressures.
So as you mentioned, this is mainly for academic purposes, for people to research. But who else do you think the university will want to access the archives? Because they are made easily accessible right off your website. You don't necessarily need a school ID to get in and view them.
Right.
Are they going for a wider appeal or strictly for research purposes?
A wider appeal. We collect and preserve these materials for UWM's teaching and research needs. But it's a public collection. We're a public university. That means that the public is invited to utilize and gain access to these materials. And there's no restriction to access. The public has already paid for these materials to be preserved and so on. There's no restriction to access for whatever reason in any way. We're not a museum. We're a research facility. And so it's meant for everybody to use. We're hoping that it'll get a really wide usage, and that'll be used in context with other digital collections that we have.
So you mentioned it is both viewable online and you can go in and physically see this. But with the digitization of this newspaper and the decrease of print newspapers overall, how do you see the future of newspapers and how do you see your project of making this newspaper more accessible?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know what's going to happen in the future, but based on my knowledge of the history of books and printing, it's one of my research areas, it seems unlikely that books will disappear, but there are certain kinds of printed materials that are more usable and useful in other media. I think perhaps the newspaper, so to speak, because once it goes online, it's no longer paper, right?
Mm-hmm.
The news reporting will probably move in that direction, in the digital direction. But you ask another question. That question is, you know, how important will the newspapers of today be for the future, or the newspapers of yesterday will be for the future? They'll be absolutely essential. Even if they're digitized, they're still essential because there's the artifact itself tells us something, its size, its format, the kind of material it was printed on, who printed it. If you look at Kaleidoscope, you can see it online. You can see that it's got all kinds of, you know, wonderful imagery and psychedelia, along with, you know, typed text. There's also lots of handwritten text. And it's very evident online. But when you get online, you have no sense of scale. You have no sense of true color. Sometimes it's really difficult to read because the print is printed over black. So it might be black on black, you know. And as much as we try to get color correction to help facilitate the reading online, there is nothing like going to the original source. So the importance of newspapers that are printed today for the future will be essential because, you know, think about, you know, in 100, 200 years, the newspaper may or may not be completely obsolete. And these artifacts will be something people will go back to and say, well, look at this. This is the way they access news in this form, on this shape, on this kind of paper. Because there's something about that medium that allows us to gain access to the content differently. You know, Marshall McLuhan called it, you know, it's either light on or light through. It affects our senses differently. So to read Kaleidoscope or the Journal Sentinel or, you know, whatever, New York Times online is not the same experience. We actually understand its content differently when we are engaged in these two different media presentations of the same content.
like you say, there's no comparison to that tangible feeling.
Right.
And luckily, with your collections of Kaleidoscope, you can both go online and see the physical collection.
Absolutely.
Max Jella, thank you for coming into Lake Fact.
My pleasure, Audrey. Thank you.
Max Jella is the head of special collections for the UW-Milwaukee Libraries. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski, and there's a link to the digitized collections of the Underground Kaleidoscope newspaper at WUWM.com.
How does NASA figure out whether astronauts are healthy enough to fly? We'll meet a UWM grad who answers just that question when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.